Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shri Govardhana Kalani ki
jai,
Shri Krishna Balaram ki
jai,
all the assembled devotees ki
jai.
Had quite a nice list of questions to ask. And they're questions that we ask each other all the time. How devotees came to Krishna consciousness, when they came to Krishna consciousness, who trained them in Krishna consciousness, and what are they going to do with the gift they've been given? It's a real nice question. And sometimes you can get huge Haribol eyes wide open, Doss. sometimes you can understand a lot about a person, especially in the older generation, when you ask those questions, if you've studied kind of the history of ISKCON. It gives lots of insights into their belief system, their values, and not so much what they've done with Krishna consciousness, but how they understood it in the nucleus part. So you all can ask that question for all of you, or all of, most all of you except for Marshall, is because of your parents, isn't it? You learned most everything from your parents in Krishna consciousness. That was your first big teacher. And then there were probably many others that became your teachers and inspired you in Krishna consciousness. So I think that, would you like to just have them ask questions?
No, are you just speaking today? I'm just doing
You're not. No, I'm doing it together.
You are?
I
think so. Well, I think he does the twosies. I think he does two at a time. Could you tell us what the questions are, and if both of us are speaking, or just one?
Usually, given the nature of the questions, there's not time for both.
I understood that.
Okay.
Okay.
So
the first one
was? How you came to Krishna consciousness, as in the circumstances that led you, and then why, as the internal, you made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then how you stay in Krishna consciousness, or what practical things you do to, or what process you follow.
Okay.
And why is your internal motivation to keep trying?
Okay.
And then there's a series of other questions I can after.
Thank you. So, I came to Krishna consciousness by the mercy of my little sister, whose name was Janki, and the year was 1966. And all of you who know the history, a little bit about you, but Prabhupada, what year did he come to America? 65. He came to, and he went to a place called Butler, Pennsylvania, and stayed with a family for some time, the Agarwal family. And then that brought him to New York, and he stayed in the YMCA and an old building for a while. And in June of 1966, he incorporated the International Society for Krishna Consciousness in New York City and started the Society of ISKCON. And over those summer months, I was getting letters from my little sister, who was there with an old friend of mine from Reed College in Portland, Oregon, whose name was Michael Grant. And he was a jazz musician, quite successful actually for being in his early 20s. He had been in San Francisco and in New York, and he was very masterful on the piano. He could play the piano really well, so that he had in his New York loft 5 pianos. And he would have jam sessions with very big, famous jazz musicians in New York scene. And Mukunda could sit down and just play anything. He could play He could play Bartok, and he could play blues, and he could play jazz, and he could play anything. And Jan, his girlfriend, could sit down and just bang on the piano, and he'd say, "What do you want me to play?" And she'd give some style of music, and he could just play a concert around her. And make it sound like they were two concert musicians on the stage. He was that good. So Mike had met Swamiji, and Swamiji was described as a saintly man from India with flowing robes and white pointy-toe shoes. Or white plastic shoes, like genie shoes, with a little pointy toe on it. And it was in a part of New York where there was lots of 20-somethings looking for the meaning of life in the mid-60s. It was right between the period of time in history called the beatniks and the hippies. Hippies hadn't quite started, and the beatniks were just still there. So there are two little 8-year generation periods. And that's where Srila Prabhupada found his first followers, in this little tiny enclave in New York City. A very small handful of devotees were attracted to him. And so over the summer, I was getting letters from them that they were going to this little storefront in the Lower East Side on 26th Second Avenue, and they were doing two things. They were learning Sanskrit, I didn't know what that was, and they were playing musical instruments and chanting, so I didn't know what that was. But they were describing it as like a happening thing, like the cool thing that they were in the summer of 66. And so then I remember there was this incredible storm one day in the fall, a summer storm, you know, sometimes that they really blow up and there's just a deluge of rain. I was sitting out on my front porch and the mailman literally burst out of this monstrous rain cloud and landed on our porch and to deliver this little blue letter from my sister. Now, these we had telephones, but we didn't use them. And there was no internet, and hi, Krishna. After the storm, the mailman said, "So you got to open the letter." So I opened it while the storm was going on, and it said, "Swamiji wants to marry us, wants us to get married. We're no more boyfriend and girlfriend. If you're going to live together, you have to get married." Whoa! A super on that.
Hare Krishna.
I have to not look at him.
He's too captivating.
He's so captivating that I find myself just staring at him.
Isn't that? It's true. Yeah. It's like when we go over down and we watch the dogs and monkeys.
It's a little different.
So cute. And it said, "We're getting married in a couple days. Can you come to the wedding?" So I've never been on an airplane. I was pretty excited about that. And so I made some arrangements to stop what I was doing and got on my first trip and up to India. And this was the day before the wedding. So the day before the wedding, Michael said, "We're going to go to lunch at the Swami's today." Swami lives just right above the temple on 26th Second Avenue. We're going to go to lunch there. Every day Swami's cooking lunch for us. So I was, have anyone heard of macrobiotics?
Yes.
An elusive thing. But it was kind of popular at that time, and macrobiotics was a vegetarian, vegan style of eating from Japan.
Nice.
And its foundation was a medium grain short rice and certain kinds of vegetables prepared a certain way, and mostly the seasonings were sea salt and crushed roasted sesame seeds. And that's pretty much all. We ate chapatis, was the foundation of our macrobiotic diet. And so I thought, well, gee, do I want to go to lunch with the Swami? And, I guess I better go. But I wonder what kind of food they're going to have here. So it's about, here's the setting. You climb, you go through the storefront, and then there's a little courtyard, and you climb this one flight of stairs to the second floor, and there's a door. It's open, a little hallway. And then you go in this room, it was about like this, and there were windows along one side, and the light was pouring in. And there were 11 boys sitting around on the floor, and my sister. She was the only girl. It was before John and Ronnie came, or any other girls. And there was Srila Prabhupada, and it was a hot day. And Jamuna had on, Jamuna was had a body like one of these little girls then. And she had on that kind of mini skirt and a tank top. Walks in this room, and Srila Prabhupada has just on his dhoti and nothing on top. He's just, he's touched. And he's standing over pots of prasadam serving out the devotees. Lunch. So, well, the minute, the first thing Mukunda said when you meet the Swami, you fold your hands and you say, Namaste Hare Krishna. So that's the first thing I said to Prabhupada my whole life was, Namaste Hare Krishna. And he kind of looked at me, whoa. Hare Krishna. The first thing. So he said, sit down. Come take lunch. So I sat on the floor, and I noticed he was, these men, a lot of them had beards, and they were kind of like, oh, it was kind of like a boys' club. It's like going to a boys' club. And they were kind of huck-hucking and laughing and everything. And I noticed that the Swami came, and he put dal, rice, vegetable, raita, and chapati on my plate. So it was hot. He used red chilies in those days. We didn't have fresh ginger and green chilies. He used what was called tepinos, and they were from Mexico. This was before Indian spice stores and Indian stores got to be evolved. So our chilies were from Mexican kind, they're tiny. The smaller the chili, the hotter the chili. And these were little dried things, and the locals, the boys called them the hot sharks, because they were really bitter taste buds. So it was this hot dal and this rice and spicy veg, and I thought, ooh, you know, I'm coming back to lunch here. And so we got through the meal somehow or another, but I noticed that the boys were eating massive quantities of one thing, chapatis. And I was told that there were 11 of them, and they could eat up to 12 chapatis at a sitting. So that means that Prabhupada made near 125 to 150 chapatis for lunch.
Oh,
that's how they became devotees. I'm convinced it was the hand of the spiritual master and his love. So you know how much work it is to make 10 chapatis. But to make that many chapatis for one meal? So he hand-fed these devotees their lunch every day. And I'm convinced that it's one of the main reasons that the New York Temple started, was Prabhupada's cooking for the devotees. That the mercy of the spiritual master through that kind of love is beyond description. So Prabhupada was very, very beautiful. A big smile, always smiling. He smiled a whole lot. So you know, when somebody serves you prasadam, think of one of your most memorable meals, when somebody who's very senior to you and who's filled with love and smiles feeds you, it's like you feel you're really being fed. You really feel like you're being nourished. So that's what that was experiencing. But for me, it was a very strange meal. So at the very end of it, we all were told to go wash our hands. And then Swami kind of earmarked me and said, so are you going to come? And I said, yes. So came and sat, and I was like a little nervous. Everybody was looking at me. So then the first thing he said, so when are the other family members coming for the wedding? And he said, oh, how unusual. This is very odd. He said, generally, if there's a wedding, the bride's family makes some nice arrangement. He said, so you're the only one? I'm the only one. So he said, so can you cook? And I said, well, not very well. He said, my servant is in a mental hospital. Oh dear. He said, so I have no one to assist me cooking tomorrow. Would you like to come cook? So Oh, I'm getting to that next. So then, this is a long story. So it turns out that his first disciple, Kirtanananda, his parents were fundamentalist Christian Baptists. And they didn't like that he had come to Krishna Consciousness Movement and had him committed to a mental hospital. So I happened to come in just at that time. So then he said, okay, tomorrow morning you can come. So then he said, about 10 o'clock, so it's good. Then he got up from where he was sitting, and he went into the far corner of the room. And when he went to that far corner of the room, I heard chuckles come up from people in the room. And Prabhupada picked up a little five pounds of Folgers coffee tin. And that was a kind of coffee, howdy not, but I don't know if somebody brought this container. And I remember when he picked it up, everybody started kind of laughing. And then I looked at it carefully and I saw like sugar syrup dripping down the outside of this tin. And I thought, oh God, there's no food. I don't want any more. I had enough for the day. And then probably he had these magnificent hands. Like, they were just so artistic, his hands. Everything about him was artistic and refined and genteel and cultured and civilized. Anyway, he took his upper fingers were raised, and he took it off. He peeled off his plastic lid. And then put the lid down, and he reached in this can with his thumb and forefinger and picked up this big brown ball that was dripping with syrup. And the minute I saw it, I thought, I don't want that. Whatever that is, I don't want it. I'm not eating sugar, right? Sugar, the idea of sugar is like the worst thing in the world. And Prabhupada said, and all everybody's laughing at this point. And he walks over to me in the whole room and said, take. And I said, oh, Swamiji, thank you very much. I've had enough for today. And I really would appreciate it. I'm sure somebody else will enjoy it more than me. And he said, take now. I was actually looking in those days, if you didn't want something and you went to someone's house, you looked for a potted plant that maybe you could take it, but then drop it in the plant before you left. So I was looking in this room for a plant. And so I put out my hand, and then he dropped this juicy, syrupy thing in it. And I said, I'm going to save it for later when I have more of an appetite. He said, no, no. And everybody is, you know, just like big smiles on their faces. And I think, oh God. So while everybody is watching me, I take this thing, I take a bite of this thing, and your first bite of Gulab Jamun, you know, the syrup bursts out of the ball and just explodes in your mouth with all these incredible tastes and sensations, and I think, oh God, I don't think I can do this again. This may be nice for them, but this might not be for me, this kind of lifestyle and diet. And he makes me finish the whole Gulab Jamun. And everybody at this point is practically cheering. You know, they're just like, yoo-hoo! We have these funny little sounds from the boys' club. And so then we wash the hands, and that's the end of round one. So tomorrow I'm to come at 10 a.m., the day of the wedding. And in preparation, Janki has, my brother's bought Janki a red Banaras silk sari with gold trim, said, and some jewelry. And Mukunda's going to wear black trousers and a black and white houndstooth oversized jacket that could fit somebody much larger than him. He got it from, you know, Goodwill or something. And a red tie that to match the sari. And a red carnation. That's the outfit that they're wearing at the wedding. And they're to string flowers in the little room in Prabhupada's apartment room that we had lunch in yesterday. That's where the wedding feast is going to be. So I get there the next morning at 10 o'clock, and I've still got my same little outfit on. And by 10 a.m., it's got to be like 85, and this apartment is one of those hot, sticky New York summers. And so before he decides to start cooking, he said, "Would you like to come see my cards?" Well, I had no idea what he was talking about. I said, "Okay, so I'm in jail." So he brought me into his bedroom where there was a little trunk. And sitting on the top of it were his ISKCON printed cards, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, a little red lotus. And he told me something about ISKCON, and I, you know, it all seemed a little strange. I thought, well, okay, so he's got a card, and he's incorporated, and what does that mean? Well, that's very nice of you, thank you for showing me. He said, "No, have you ever shopped in New York before?" I said, "No, well, it's my first time in New York. I just came yesterday." He said, "So I'm going to give you a list to go out and shop for some things that I really need for the wedding feast. And I'll begin preparing." So the feast is to be out at 5 o'clock. So it's 10. So we have about, you know, six, seven hours to finish everything. And he told me where to go out with a list. And in New York, there's these little corner grocery stores on every corner, practically. So he told me what store to go in. We came back, and he opened the door. First thing he asked me, "Did you get everything on the list?" And the first thing I did to him was lie and say yes. And I had. So there was one thing on the list that the man at the grocery store had no idea what it was. It's called HOLD. H-A-L-D. Or H-U-L-D. And nobody knew what HOLD was. So, can you imagine cooking a whole feast without turmeric?
No.
HOLD is turmeric. And I said, "No, there's one that I'm doing." Nobody knows what is HOLD. I said, "Well, my servant can get it for me." So I immediately felt nervous. I said, "Oh, I'm not, you know, I'm just a new corner." So anyway, he said, "All right, never mind." He said, "I'll make do without." And so then he said, "Today I have you make a medium hard dough for some pastries you want to make. They're called kutchinis. So can you make a medium hard dough?" I said, "Well, I can make chouan flow dough and pâté brisé, and I've handled a few kinds of doughs." He said, "How old are you?" "I'm 25, Swamiji." "I said, you're 25 and you can't make a medium hard dough?" I said, "Well, I don't know what a medium hard dough is." "Any girl 5 years old in India, she can make." So immediately I was getting nervous again. He said, "Never mind, I will show you how." And he had a 5-pound bag of Betty Crocker flour, all-purpose flour, a couple pounds, there was no ghee, a couple pounds of butter, and a pitcher of water, one of those salt. And he just went, the dough was done. Okay. So I got that idea. He said, "No, this is a little bit difficult." He said, "I will make the stuffing, you will make the dough, and here is how you assemble the dough." So anybody who has ever made, who's made kachoris? Raise your hand. One person. Were they, what kind of kachoris? Potato. Okay. So there's two different shapes, basically, for kachoris. One is a little patty, round about this size, which is your size. And another one is shaped in, it's about that to start with, and then it's rolled out. So it's like a stuffed puri. And that's double fried. So this first one is only fried once. But there is no other, ever, any cooking I've ever studied of a pastry that is fried for 20 minutes. For 18 to 20 minutes. There's a very exact science for making kachoris, this kind of kachoris, this custard kachori kind of thing, because it has to be fried at just the right temperature. Otherwise, what happens when you fry something too slow? It gets greasy. It absorbs grease. Mm. And if you fry too fast, it will be raw. Mm. So it's really quite tricky. Mm. It's the most difficult of... It couldn't be a more difficult thing for a first-time person to ever do. Wow. And if you don't seal them properly, what happens when you try to fry them? Mm. They blow apart. The seams, just as soon as they hit the oil, they just go... And the filling comes out and goes all through the oil. So Lord forbid, this young girl, Joan Campanella, was given the job of making cassiori for 6 hours in this hellishly hot room with just like sweat pouring off the inlay of my skirt, seated cross-legged. And I could see him to Srila Prabhupada in his little galley kitchen. And that was one of the most profound days, to watch Prabhupada cook. Because my mother kind of thought she was a good cook, and she was, for being a 50s kind of mom. She got expensive ingredients anyway. But Swamiji, I noticed that he did lots of things all alone with his hands. He mixed, he measured, he... braid, he whisked, he stirred, he did many things, and he went seamlessly from one thing to another and had a whole lot going. So there were nearly 40 people at this wedding feast, and Srila Prabhupada had made 11 dishes for 40 people in 6 hours, including frying cassiori. It was really miraculous. And the first batch of cassioris that I did blew up. And he came and he said, if you don't seal them properly, he said, then all this filling will come out. And so he had to then drain through a sieve all the oil, start again. So for 6 hours I did this job. And in that 6 hours, I probably made every serious offense that you can to cooking. And it was the first day or the second day that I was with Srila Prabhupada, I got lots of instruction from him. Because the first question I asked after about an hour and a half of cooking, I said, Swamiji, could I take a little cigarette break? And he walked with him in the corner and he said, go wash your hands. He didn't say yes or no. He said, go wash your hands. So I got up and washed my hands. Came back and he said, the thing is, today we're making a special kind of food. It's for Krishna's pleasure. It's called Krishna Prasad. And he said, when we cook Krishna Prasad, we don't smoke cigarettes.
Straight from the material world. I've never heard the word Krishna before.
So I said, okay. So then later, I said, Swamiji, can I have a glass of water? Go wash your hands. So I go wash my hands. And now, one thing is when we're cooking for Krishna, we don't eat or drink anything. Oh, that's strange. He said, this is for Krishna's pleasure, so we don't even think about this. And later, we can't eat, we can't drink, we smoke. What could possibly happen later? So the room, as I said, was really hot, and it was so hot that sweat was dripping down my cheeks from my hair. And I reached up and I went like this, and I wiped the perspiration off. He saw it and he said, go wash your hands. I said, so one thing that when we do this cooking, that a whole new standard of cleanliness evolved. He said, so if you're going to sweat, he said, you have to wear like something around. So Radha came in with a little baking bandana on, and I was just laughing, thinking of that, because actually that's one of the reasons chefs wear hats. Did you know that in Jagannath Puri, when the cooks cook for the deity in Jagannath Puri, they all take a full meal before they begin their cooking, so there's no question of hunger, put on clean clothes, and because it's inside, there's up to 500 wood fires in a small area. The ceiling is just black with smoke. So they put on clean clothes, but they wrap their whole bodies, including their faces and heads, so just their eyes are showing, because it's so hot in there, and the sweat would be there, and would get them contaminated. The food. So it was a whole three big, huge things were taught to me that first day, cooking with Srila Prabhupada in the kitchen. And what I noticed about him was I forgot to tell you, he did feed me. After I came back from shopping, he gave me a glass of lassi and a little ninki. It's a little biscuit, was flavored with black pepper and lemon. And to this day, those Bengali ninkis are... I don't think I've ever even been taught you to make ninkis. Oh, they're so good. There's a whole school. Ninkis would be like samosas or kachoris, so many varieties. But this was black pepper lemon. And they're little fried crackers. Buttery fried crackers. And he gave me those two things that morning. So then there was this amazing wedding with the bride and groom and all the laughy guys again. And a bunch of people from the Malay side. And Swamiji presented us to build a fire in the middle of the room, a little wood fire with guys on everything. And it was all like very foreign to me, no wedding I'd ever seen before. And this is yesterday, Ujjama said her husband's being flown into the foreign wedding. So the kind of weddings that Prabhupada did was really different than his fun weddings. There was the fire yajna, which was a very sacred event and only focusing on the physical aspects of the fire yajna itself and chanting of sacred mantras. And then there was the group putting the bananas and grains on the fire, and then it was kirtan, and that was it. No more Hindu or Indian or anything. The walking around, there was the tying of the dhoti to the side. So there was nothing to tie Jackie's sari to. I think he had a bow tie on, so that was a problem. She put her sari end into his jacket pocket. And then the first kirtan I ever heard in my life was this. And Srila Prabhupada picked up a bongo drum. Does anybody know what a bongo drum is? It's a little kind of two-headed drum. It's kind of a tabla. Crude tabla. And Prabhupada played this bongo drum that somebody had given him. And then there were kartals. And at first, I felt a little nervous to chant, but everybody was chanting, so I thought I'd try it. And I closed my eyes. And I think from that day, every kirtan I've ever been in, I've kept my eyes closed. To not see what's going on, but hear what's going on. And after about 5 minutes, I surrendered to the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. And that was just an amazingly wonderful experience. Of devotees, who you ask them how they came to Krishna consciousness, everybody has their story of the first kirtan that grabbed them, that caught them in some way, in some meaningful way. It's a really important part of your spiritual life. So that was my first. And then I spent the next only about 7 to 8 days in New York. Came to the morning program every morning with Mukunda. Janki didn't come. Janki was very traumatized actually by a lot of the experience of her first of the initiation and the wedding. And the boys weren't very nice actually to the girls. They were kind of, has anybody heard of the word misogynistic? That means it's, you know how when guys get together, they do got a guy thing? When there's a lot of 11 of them together and no girls, the girls kind of like, ooh, there's a girl here, kind of thing. So they weren't really nice. They're so nice. And actually, I think I would have become attracted to Krishna consciousness more if the boys had been nice. Mm-hmm. Swamiji was awfully nice, but the boys were a little harsh. So I wasn't, so I didn't think it was maybe for me, this thing. But I liked Swamiji very much. And Mukunda Janki and one of Mukunda's friends, Maurice, he was a gypsy, and I got a driveway car from New York and drove, the car was to be delivered in San Francisco. It was a cheap way to travel for all of us to go, because I paid for the gas in this car. And on the way, I said, well, why don't we go up to Oregon first and pick up my friends, Sam and Melanie, because they're in a mountain lookout tower working for the U.S. Forest Service. And I said, maybe they might come down to San Francisco with us. We could pick them up. So we drove up there, and Sam and Melanie turned out to be Shamsugar and Malati. Boyfriend and girlfriend, floating up in this mountain tower. And so we picked them up, and we all drove down to San Francisco together. And then Janki and Mukunda were the only initiates. And Sam and Melanie and Joan were the newcomers, and we rented a place together, Sam and Melanie. I had known them for already a long time. And we rented a place in San Francisco in November of 66. And fixed it up, and on January 14th, 1967, Srila Prabhupada came to San Francisco, his first airplane ride. Remember, he took the Jaladutta boat from India, mm-hmm. and he flew to San Francisco, and we started our second ISKCON temple on 518 Frederick Street, San Francisco. And Srila Prabhupada stayed with us from mid-January to just before, well, I guess it was May, early May. And we collected a wonderful group of devotees who were attracted to Srila Prabhupada in San Francisco. Half of them were boys and half were girls. So it wasn't like New York, it was a real nice balance of male and female energy. And we felt, all of us felt very much like a family. Mm. Srila Prabhupada was the father, and the mother, and our best friend, and the spiritual preceptor, and the most exciting person we'd ever met in our lives. He had more energy than a whole bunch of 20-year-olds put together. He didn't sleep. He was just like things we've never seen in a human being. And we knew he was saintly. We knew he was different than anybody else. Everybody had a different idea of what spiritual was. Mm. And so, in the West are mostly Christian, but in that period of time, Buddhism was beginning a little popular. So my idea of somebody was a Buddhist who controlled their senses and didn't have to talk much. Peaceful. And the problem was all that and so much more. So that's the first. You want to ask questions or shall I just continue? Well, Sam and Melanie met Prabhupada, of course, when he came, and by the end of the month they were initiated. Wow. 2 weeks after they met Prabhupada. And I didn't like that so much. I couldn't figure out how they could do that. Because I had already met Srila Prabhupada, and I thought, I don't know if I can commit that fast. How can they commit for a whole lifetime in 2 weeks? But they did. They felt they could. And so, but for me, I just wasn't sure at all. So one of the persons that I met there was, I just had a boyfriend for 5 years, and then broke off a relationship with him. And so one of the people that came, his name was Roger, who was a photographer. And Roger and I kind of became friends, and then kind of boyfriend, girlfriend. And Roger had permission to go and stay in a mountain cabin on the California coast in an old logging camp for a month. And I thought, well, that kind of sounds like fun, because I think I'm going to make an experiment. I want to leave the devotees' company And I want to follow the four rules and regulations while we're at this place for a month and see if I can do it without any peer pressure or without Swamiji. And because they were having their last Siddhi Guru, you know, right at the door.
Wow.
So I went, and from the first day, I just started chanting Hare Krishna. It was a wood fire, no electricity. So I kind of like Sharanagati. And there was a picking wild, you know, fruits from the old gardens that had been there, or veggies and herbs and things. And so I stopped all intoxication, no meat anymore. All the four, no illicit connections, no kisipu, nothing. And started chanting Hare Krishna. And within 3 days, my whole consciousness changed. Roger started to feel really alienated from me. He said, what's going on? You're acting really different. But I never told him what I was doing. I thought I'd just do it. Mm. I'm just enjoying the place. And so it only took about 7 days before I realized that I didn't want to stay there a month away from Swamiji. And I wanted to become a devotee. And so we had to call up and inform them to come up in the car and dress. When Roger came back in. And Srila Prabhupada had a little apartment in the little storefront, 518, was down on here next to the Chinese laundry. And just on the next to the Chinese laundry was the entrance to an apartment building at 512 Frederick, and that probably was on the third floor, apartment 35. Janky and McCormick apartment 33, 2 doors down. So they were kind of like hosting. They were the senior most people in a group, and they were hosting that Srila Prabhupada. So I asked McCormick, I said, well, I'd like to talk to Swamiji. Mm-hmm. And so he arranged for me to go. And Srila Prabhupada had a rocking chair. They had arranged, I'm always addicted to rocking chairs. This Prabhupada loved that rocking chair in San Francisco. And he'd sit in it by his bay window and chant. He had a big, something made him, I think I know, but there's somebody in New York, some huge, big bead bag that hung off the edge of this rocking chair. So I came in, and his eyes got big. Oh, you're back. Yes, Swamiji. He said, so right away, he said, so what are your plans? Swamiji, I'd like to go to the highest place, to Tibet. And then I said, I think Tibet is the highest place. He was really sober, and he was looking. So you will hear sometimes devotees when they describe being in Srila Prabhupada's presence, that he was able to look at you, but he looked through you. He saw inside you. He could see your heart. He could see your soul. He could see your thoughts. It was a very powerful experience. It wasn't as if you're just glancing. It was full presence, full presence. So he looked down, he was up in this rocking chair, and I was on the ground. And I remember Srila Prabhupada had his eyes at that point were half open, and he was looking down, and there were little gray slits of illumination. From his eyes, they became very intense to me. And he said in a very quiet voice, he said, I can take you to a place much higher than Tibet. Just see. Just see. And I got goosebumps on my arms. And my hair stood on the end of my body. I said, okay, I'll see. I'd like to see. And that was the moment that I decided to commit myself to trying to relish the process of Krishna consciousness with Srila Prabhupada and his spiritual master. So I'm a little dull in that respect. Some of my God brothers and God sisters were much faster in coming to that. But I wanted to try to be sure that I could do it before I said I could, because I thought it was really serious. It was a serious choice. Becoming a devotee wasn't something that we took lightly. Mm. It was something actually, a very sober decision. Is that true for you?
Yeah, for sure.
I think, yeah, when you haven't been born, but I think it's same for you in some ways. You can't live your parents' religion. You have to live it for yourself. Mm. On your own terms, don't mm-hmm. you? You're happy that your parents are devotees, and your parents can say, can't give you anything better. This is the best thing you can, but you have to find that, don't you? Because it doesn't mean anything if you do it for someone else.
Right.
You've got to do it for yourself. So we all come to that point where we say, oh, this is a short life. I had so many lives. I've been conditioned in the material world for so many births. Not only human births, but so many. Let me just give this one life to seriously trying to take to this process of Krishna consciousness. So that's kind of the decision you make when you want to take Diksha. First initiation. So, then that was a very amazing experience of Diksha. And then, so he noticed where us and I were living, Roger was living. He said, no, you cannot. You don't live together without being married. That was a very strong first injunction. So the next day we were married. Jay, right? Boom, boom. So I borrowed Janky's red silk sari, and Gurdas borrowed the one yellow dhoti in our temple, which was from Hayagriva Brahmachari from New York. They had to give it up for a whole week. No dhotis, no saris in ISKCON there, so we just go. So we borrowed those, and we were initiated on March 4th. 1967. And then, since then, it's just been an adventure. An ongoing adventure of discovery of beauty. There's nothing. When my sister had trouble with Krishna consciousness in 69, and actually came in and said to Prabhupada, I'm leaving the devotees. Prabhupada got big tears in his eyes. He cried. Then he looked at her and he said, you will not find a better philosophy in this whole world. There's nothing like the knowledge that we have in Krishna consciousness. And every morning that we read Bhagavatam, we come to the same conclusion. There is nothing like the potency of Srimad Bhagavatam. I mean, it just over and over, you can read the same chapters. The Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Nectar of Devotion, and the CC, these are the main big works that Prabhupada translated. Mm-hmm. So many small books were compiled from them. Mm-hmm. But these literatures have in it information. I mean, the things we read this morning were just phenomenal. How, you know, sound comes from the larynx, and how air is needed. The wind god is the representative of the air that makes the larynx allow speech to come. I mean, the most scientific, beautiful information that was all centered on Krishna and Krishna's arranging for this to happen. So we get information that is just like nowhere else. Mm. And the holy name, my God. The holy name for the way of this age, to try to understand what pure chanting is. Now, I am just past, and he was somebody who sat in Vrindavan for 25 years, really focusing at the lotus feet of the Lord, never leaving Vrindavan and chanting. And so what is the difference of different kinds of chanting? Offensive, shadow chanting, pure chanting. That journey of understanding and relishing Krishna as the holy name, nothing like that. They said there's nothing like our philosophy. We're the best philosophy. There's nothing like our food. They said you won't find any other kind of nourishment like Krishna consciousness. And there's a never-ending art of pleasing Krishna with different taste combinations through this science of cooking. And he said, and we have the best dress, the best company, is it please don't fall. But when the false ego comes in and we become covered over by not following the process, which just happens quickly, doesn't it? Forgetting Krishna can happen really quickly. We know it in a day. And if you look at at a 24-hour day, at where your mind goes, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It can go all kinds of places, can't it? In 24 hours, in 5 minutes, it can go all kinds of places. But so when we don't follow the process the Prabhupada gave us, then we become a little dull and our ideas become very prominent and our will sometimes really gets prominent and we get a little weak and we can forget Krishna quickly. So he gave us this process. He said, it's glorious, please take it. Make it your life. This life goes by so quickly. I know when you're a teenager, it seems like forever, between 1 year and the next. But, even for you, you're in your mid-30s now, you're in your early 30s. Doesn't it go by fast? It really does.
Especially when you have children.
And when you're children, and the more you have, the more, I think that's another number too. Yeah, it does. We measure time differently, each one of us, but it really does. I'm almost 70 years old, 69 years old, and I'm just 68. All right, I'm 2 years off 70. And it goes fast. That's all I can say. I was 25, and it seems like, just a few days ago. Just shoots by. Mm. But we want to commit. We want to get to the big commit word. How do we get to the big commit word? Hear nicely. Try to associate with people that are more advanced than we are. Put time into the process of self-realization. Look at it. Well, how am I doing? Where can I be better? What do I need to make stronger? And, just baby step by baby step, go to the goal. And it's the peace formula. It's this, Rilamba just said it this morning, it's the path of freedom. Mm. We're all looking for freedom, aren't we? In the material world, they have a song that says, "Let freedom ring." Mm. So we want that freedom. But actually, we're bound up like almost in shackles, almost as if we're shackled down by material consciousness. There is no freedom better than the freedom of Krishna consciousness. And sometimes when devotees so-called loop or they get weak and they go away and leave the process, they're almost always looking for some kind of freedom, separate from Krishna. Mm. Where they don't have to do the Krishna rules. So, it's a very wonderful process. We have the most wonderful guides. We have support systems everywhere if we just know where to look for them. Like sometimes it's said we don't, but we actually do. And so now you can ask me questions if there's any.
When you were chanting those 3 days, like, you hadn't known much about Krishna, so what did you think of and concentrate on? You just listened?
I just got in a groove. I decided that what was really strange, I thought I'm going to chant all day. Mm-hmm. And when I collected the wood, when I was building the fire, when I was cooking, I just never stopped chanting.
Wow.
And it was the most wonderful experience. I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to see what it feels like. And it was more or less, except for sleeping, a 24-hour kirtan.
Wow.
And I couldn't stop. I was so shocked at how beautiful it was. And I did it alone, actually. Roger was in his room with his dog, Ketal, doing whatever they were doing. And I just got caught up in it. Give it a try sometime. Take a day out in your life. And it's best when you're alone. That's why this was a good thing. There weren't people to talk to and stuff. It was a test where I could actually see if I liked this. And it was just really very, very, very powerful experience. It seemed that as if, like breathing, it was breathing fresh air.
Wow.
It was like you know, when you're really present and peaceful, and you're not desiring something or lamenting or hankering or lamenting over something, then you can really get into the holy name. Or suppose we have a really powerful prayer session. It's like that, when you're in it. And you just don't want to do anything else. Nothing else, you nowhere else I'd rather be. It's like that, but you're alone. And that's powerful because sometimes you're with Krishna. Because actually Krishna is on your tongue. And that, for the first time that happens to you, just blows you away. And then it just gets better and better. But a lot of devotees, you know, don't explore that personal side so much. They like the instruments and the quantity and the heavy drumming and the whole sensual experience of interchanging with others around them. It's a powerful experience. But the chant alone is also very, very glorious. There was one statement that Prabhupada in New York in his early part of 66, when he was in a room alone, and he said, "I was chanting to the four walls. No one else is there." But he was with Krishna. So that first time is a good one. Make a test, whatever you have a chance to see what it's like. There's some in 69 when we were in London, we had three new girls that came. They were our first devotees in England. They were all from France. And the four of us in the service of Radha Vandaneshwara actually chanted all day. If we weren't out on Nagar Kirtan, we chanted all the time when we were cooking, when we were serving prasadam, when then we read together. And this girl hadn't seen Mandakini for many years. She came to visit Radha Vandavihari one year. And it was, you know, 23 years later. And when we were together here in our Sharanagati ashram, we did that again. We just chanted all day. And we got right back into our groove because that's what we grew up doing together. So it can be an experience that you just look forward to those few people. It's usually a handful of people that have that kind of intense bond where you all you want to do is chant together. Yeah. It's a nice question. Yes.
What was your life like before becoming a devotee, and how do you think it would have played out if you never found Krishna consciousness? Mm.
I was just in a conditioned soul bound up by that which I had been taught by my parents. I grew up in an upper middle class, a little bit moneyed community, and it's my 50th year, the reunion. Right now, the people I went to high school with this weekend in Portland, Oregon, or Lake Oswego, Oregon, are all together having a barbecue, a country club dance, a round of golf, and a boating regatta, for relishing their high school years together. And I looked on the website and for these people, and all the women had, they didn't look like they were 68 years old. They all had blonde hair, and it was all gone blonde, and they put things in their face to make the wrinkles go away, called Botox. They were all blonde with wrinkleless faces, so they hadn't aged. And I'd say 95% had PhDs, very wealthy. Most of them, I think, are very wealthy material. And, you know, they like to go hunting and fishing and traveling around the world in their old age. Somewhere like that. Any other questions?
What made you think of Tibet when you mentioned that to Shiva?
When I left, I went to the University of Oregon for my first semester. And that was such a shock because, at least the university I went to, they had this thing called sororities. And the first semester of your freshman year means you get pledged to a sorority or fraternity. And I was so shocked at the emphasis placed on this.
Mm-hmm.
That it just freaked me out, actually. It just, I thought, this is so false. And the men had to be like, just be able to drink huge amounts of intoxication
and act like complete, total idiots. And the girls had to, by the end of the first semester, I just said, I can't do this. Just won't work for me. And I told my poor parents, they were so shocked, they bought me a little sports car and everything to be a nice little successful college team. And it wouldn't work. So I got my first job in college at a big department store over Christmas break, and met my old junior high friend from Salem, Oregon, Sam Spearster, who was Sam Schindler, while I had that job. And he was going to be. And so I started taking ceramics and calligraphy lessons from the most famous calligrapher in North America at the time. His name was Dr. Lloyd Reynolds. And he was a practicing Buddhist. And his discipline, and he was a great teacher. One of those few teachers that you get that it doesn't matter what the subject is, they're just really good teachers. And so you like what they're teaching. It's like you love Krishna consciousness because of because he's such a good teacher. So you get those rarely in your life, but you do get those sometimes. So he had the whole, it was Tibetan Buddhism that he was mostly revealing the discipline between eye, inside, and external awareness through pen and ink and paper. And we ground our own ink and we learned to use a pen where you're barely touching the paper. It's just capillary action that's holding your nib to the paper. It was a very amazing experience. So I was very riveted by that and earth, touching earth, centering earth on a spinning wheel. So it helped me to understand what being centered was. And when you're off center, you can't throw a pot. The pot just the plate flies out to you. You can't turn it up in your life and see. So those two experiences of disciplines were what I focused on and set up college for about 4 years. And this boy that I met ultimately, he was his mentor for 4 or 5 years. And he was just a genius, about 180 IQ. But he was also just really gifted with his hands. And he carved and did calligraphy and pottery and all kinds of other things. And so we opened a shop in San Francisco in a very happening place called Grant Street. It was called the Pot Shop. And I sold my calligraphy and pottery, and we sold pot. So we were rich because of him, not because of me. But I mean to say that was just the I slipped out. Yeah.
It's okay, it shows your past experience and then transformation.
The condition.
That's the way the days were back then.
Yeah.
And still are.
We're all caught up. Yeah, your generation is caught up in what it's caught up in. Every generation is caught up in something. There's no generation that isn't. Mm. But we talked about it actually in Bhagavatam class this morning. We were all stunned because we were picking up Sanatana Goswami. And he passed in 1558 AD, which is really very recent. And the world he lived in, how different it is than the world we live in now. Such a different world, and the world that your children will live in by the time your kids are 20 and your kids are 25. It is a very fast-changing world through technology. This technology has taken over so much more than our world. And Prabhupada wrote Srimad Bhagavatam, he couldn't have conceived that there'd be something like the internet and a microchip and these waves going through the ether where a picture can be transmitted just like in Bhagavad Gita from one place to another without wires. That was, I mean, to make a telephone call in India in 1970, you had to book a call almost a week ahead. And then when it came time for the call, you picked it up and you said, "Hello!" Then the other person screamed, "Hello, can you hear me?" And there was no sound, and you put the phone down. That was booking a call, honestly. And if you were really lucky, you had a tape recorder. It was called a portable tape recorder, about this big with a little handle on it and some batteries. And boy, you could listen to tapes. You know, bulky, very, you know, very bulky. 10 cassette tapes were a lot of weight. And that was the technology of that age. If you had something really important to say, you got to send a telegram from Western Union. And they charged by each letter, and a period was even, and a stop in between was a charge. So you got about 3 sentences, like, urgent, death, date. Come, and that was it. You know, it's very, for really serious. That was the technology. So it's fast moving. It means that you have to pay attention. Got to really focus. And if you want your spiritual life, never just take it for granted. Think, I'm a devotee. I don't have to do this. Every day is important. Every day. Prabhupada said, actually, he gave us the instruction to have a personal relationship with the deity that you worship. Talk to your deity. Report to your deity. Ask for his help. You know, do that with people that you love and value. And everything will be very, very bright and wonderful. Your future is so bright and wonderful. You've got everything. Yes, yes. Do you know what today is? Sanatana Goswami, the second full moon in the month of July, August, mm-hmm. in the Indian calendar today, is called Guru Purnima in India. Mm. It's more or less a Hindu celebration. It's even the Mayavadis celebrate Guru Purnima. It was originally established as the day that you worship Vyasadeva, who was considered the original guru. But for us, because it is the disappearance day of Sanatana Goswami, we worship especially our guru and Sanatana Goswami. And you may know already that whenever I go to Vrindavan, we go to Vrindavan, after seeing Srila Prabhupada at his samadhi, the first place that I always go is the samadhi of Sanatana Goswami. And the reason is that he is especially merciful to people who approach him to make advancement in spiritual life and pray to him to make advancement. So please take advantage of this day to pray to Sanatana Goswami that you'll get attachment for the process of Krishna consciousness and the ability to increase your chanting and hearing and your sincerity for the process. It's a very special and powerful day for that reason. Yeah, even though this group is small, it's one of the most beautiful groups of devotees on the planet. Mm-hmm. They're all so fortunate to have each other's company and to be in this little ragtag, you know, tour of a school that's the best school on the whole planet, because the intent of the teachers are so focused to give you the best, the gift, as it's been given. And it's working. You can feel it in your hearts, can't you? It's just so clear, you can feel it in your hearts. So I just feel always so grateful to Karen and Radha when they finally came here, and hopefully Shyam Kishore and Rasamrita will be a part of taking, you know, your generation and giving the best of what you've learned from it to the next generation, and this will go on, because it's such a valuable, wonderful thing. We wish you so much. Well, in your journey, Marshall being your brother, and you're doing so good, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It just makes me totally happy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's about it, if there's anything else. Thank you for your time and your company.
Sure. Yes, God.
Yes, a couple more questions, and we'll just do the offering.
Okay.
You mentioned the Scott Gentle Swami is especially merciful to people that want to aspire in the process, and I picked up several things from your talk that that inspired me to, you know, to what direction to go and how to go, but could you speak on that a little bit more? Because one of our challenges now in this generation, this day and age, is Krishna consciousness is now not so far out, you know, it doesn't blindside you with its novelty, and it's a cultural thing at home, you know, for this generation. Mm-hmm. How can we even aspire, you know?
Wow. Well, what you're doing is working. What you're doing is working. I keep coming back to purity. This adage or maxim, purity is a force. That there's a lot of knowledge out there in this world, but to be able to get pure knowledge so close away from the founder Acharya of ISKCON, through his books and through at least some of his disciples, the more who pray for purity without being fanatics, don't follow just rules to follow rules, but follow it because they love it, they love Krishna consciousness, and they've tasted that Krishna consciousness brings the highest happiness. It brings peace of mind. So many people now feel so frustrated with life. Mm-hmm. It's not uncommon to find, after your teens are hard enough, right? With your hormones flowing and just doing all kinds of stuff, it's hard enough to be a teenager. But then all of a sudden when you're 20, you're supposed to be grown up and move out of home. And between 20 and 30, a lot of people that are in that time slot between 20 and 30 just feel, what do I do? What do? I'm supposed to make a lot of money. I'm supposed to have a job. I'm supposed to know how to raise kids. I'm supposed to know how to do everything you do and everything for the first time. You can go to school and they can supposedly teach you all this stuff, but the playing field is always new and different. You know, now, you know, sometimes it'll be easier to find a job. Sometimes it'll be harder to find a job. Sometimes it'll be easier to be peaceful in your family life. Sometimes it's hard. So all of a sudden you're expected to do stuff and it's all new. So that's why spiritual life is really a strong foundation. The more you can feel the support and the power and the purity of something that has worked for how long? We can at least say for in this modern age, we can say from Bhaktivinoda Thakur to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to Bhaktivedanta, we can know that before Vaishnavism was lost a little bit between the six Goswamis, and when Bhaktivinoda really brought it, and we studied from Salaki to Jivani, so we know this now. And look at the struggle that Bhaktivinoda went through in his life. This is our fourth reading of this book, isn't it? Third or fourth? And every time I read it, I'm stunned at how much his whole family, they went through so many reversals, but it was this Krishna consciousness, and look at the wisdom. So when we hear these prayers about the holy name, they just you know, make your heart melt. They're so powerful. So take advantage of what you've been given. Pray for what you don't have and you need. And Krishna helps us. If we really want it, Krishna, I promise you, Krishna will help every one of you in need. So never feel alone. Never. This is one process. This is one place
where you never, ever need to feel alone. And there's very few places that can assure that. The only planet. I'm sure Dina could answer the question better than I
know. I just enjoy this. You know, the most amazing thing is I've heard these stories of how Jamuna became a devotee 100 times. Is it 100 times? And every time I hear it, it's like the first time. You know, it's so relishable. I love to hear that.
It's nice to hear how devotees came. There's so many devotees that love to write books on that. But each person has a wonderful story, and they're always exciting. Every story is glorious because every devotee is glorious. So few that have the good fortune in this age to come to hear about Krishna, what to speak of, take up the process. When you look on the whole planet, it's not got numbers, but the numbers that it has can be very powerful. Anything else? What do you have, Krishna? Sri Dhamma, nothing? Make yourself satisfied.
Thank you so much, both of you, for the oceans of mercy and love that you have.
Thank you.
Gorgeous.
I'm so happy being with
such cool company. Yeah. And there's a hunger, it's called Gomya, where you really want, with your deepest part of your soul, you want to take the time to explore Krishna consciousness. And that's called self-realization. It's different for all of us, isn't it? Your closest friend can't realize Krishna the way you do, but you can sure share a lot in the process of finding it. That's the nectar of having sangha people that are kind of in the, what's called, on the same page. They're different kinds of friendships than any other kind of friendship that there is.
It's so fascinating to hear both of you speak about those early days. Such groundbreaking, amazing time.
Yeah, Prabhupada was in his time. Every acharya, they're preaching the field. And you look at Bhaktivinoda's preaching field, and Bhaktisiddhanta's preaching field, and Gaudiya's preaching field. The time was right there. All of us know that in the 30s, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura sent one Maharaj to England. This was the late 30s, just before the Second World War in England. And while he had the opportunity to meet very parts of high society, lords and ladies and ministers and such, the climate just was not right for making a huge impact on society at that time. And when we look at Srila Prabhupada, he didn't meet lords and ladies. He met these, you know, hippies, you know, young people in their early 20s. But somehow or another, by Krishna's incredible arrangement, Srila Prabhupada was able to, in a very, very fast time, he was only here with us 11 years, and there was 100 temples, and, you know, tens of thousands of people were chanting Hare Krishna. And it's quite fascinating also how young people were so empowered. We were young. We had no qualification. When I'm saying your 20s are a big adventure time, we didn't know, you know, bookkeeping and and preaching and gotta be clean and how to chant, really how to worship the deity, everything that it takes to run a temple. And there were some devotees that were 18 that were presidents of temples in a whole country with no other devotees in them. South Africa was started by an 18-year-old devotee who just went and Prabhupada said, go start a temple. In England, there was just 6 of us. And in 2 years, what happened in 2 years was just absurd. You know, it was just impossible. We didn't know what we were doing. But we were just enthusiastic to try. That's really something. So that is what I want you to try to catch, that wave. That moonbeam of Krishna magic that allows you to do things that you never thought you could do. They're way far away from your comfort zone. But they're just because you love your spiritual master, he said to do it. And with his blessings, the lame man can walk over mountains, the dumb man can speak, and the blind man can see. That's the mercy factor, the big, huge mercy factor. So Prabhupada was really good at that. Partly because we talk about love so much, don't we? The importance of love. Prabhupada truly loved his disciples. Mm-hmm. And he saw them as his real family. He said, I have left my own family. And now you are my family. And he said, now how many children I have. He left his family behind. And got a huge family of devotees. So that is something quite miraculous when you study Prabhupada's life in the context of the times and the miracle of what happened while he was with us and how he empowered. He wanted so much for us to be Krishna conscious that we caught that and did things that we just Krishna did. Sometimes I felt like I was, in your play. When sometimes you do the marionettes, the little guys dancing, and they flop down, and they jump back up. And I felt that we were on these strings, and Prabhupada was pulling the strings and making us dance. There's in his Jaladutta prayer, and the Jaladutta prayer is the last verse, Prabhupada says, make me dance, make me dance, make me dance, my Lord. I'm just like a puppet in your hand. And that's what I actually have felt in my whole Krishna conscious life. I felt I was dragging some kind of an invisible Sika back here because I'm a girl. Allowing us to dance the dance of Krishna consciousness. And that's our Parambara system. That's the power of the Parambara. So juicy. So nectar. And it's there for you guys. Doesn't end with us. Mm-hmm. You get to, yes, bro. Finished.
you said how Prabhupada was kind of the puppeteer and he gave a lot of direct instructions and propelled a lot of stuff to happen. Mm-hmm. And now it's harder for us to find that.
Yes, it is.
But it's harder for us to find.
I agree with you.
So, I also can't help but think a lot that people like yourselves must see people like myself and must say, what are you doing with your life? So if you were us, or if you were knew everything that you knew or we know now, what would you do with your life?
That's a very difficult one, and I can answer probably in different ways and different ways. But I'd say that the answer is out there waiting to find. Your questions and your answers are out there just waiting for you to claim them. One favorite quote of mine is from an anthropologist, material versus woman, her name is Margaret Mead. And she said that the quality of the outcome depends on the quality of the questions. So in First Canto's second chapter, purport to survive from some Varodharma or something, six or seven, Prabhupada says that this whole material world is simply questions and answers. Students in the colleges, their business is questions and answers. Or in school, questions and answers. He said the birds in their nests, they are asking questions and answers. The lawyers in the court, they are asking questions and answers. So from that I was thinking, yes, if we ask the right question and the quality of the question is good, then it's just a matter of time till, through Super Soul, Krishna directs you to the answer. But there has to be a little bit sincerity, isn't it? Sincerity and intent must be there. To the degree that you're sincere
and your intent is there, the result will come. And it's never in the time frame you want it, right? Right? Never. We have our own idea of, I want it now. Right? I want it now. I don't like it. This doesn't feel right. I want it now. But then it always comes in Krishna's time. And for that, it's such a big one that I can honestly say, I don't know the timing. But I know that the answers are there for you. And, you know, it sounds like maybe just something you've heard before, but the more you follow the process in your heart, and the more you aspire for good company, the faster it'll come. Don't get, like, you know, just lazy and think, yeah, it's there, but I gotta do this, 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 and this. So then everything goes a little slower. There has to be some urgency. That's this longing. And you know, it says in a Bhagavatam that alavya, it's like 1/11th of a second, is all it takes of time between your question being answered and being in total anxiety. It's that fast. So for me, it was just see, just see. The minute those words came out, the Prabhupada's mouth, just see, it was like my invitation, you know. Go back to God. So when you ask the right person the right question, it will come for you too. And you want to be able to trust the person. You want to be able to put your life in their hands, because if you don't trust somebody, it's really hard to do what's called surrender, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It has to be more than just something superficial. Right? Because we're all vulnerable and we all want the right things and to go as fast as we can, but we need to have some trust there. So that's a really good question, and it will be different for all of you how that answer is revealed, but I can absolutely promise you that it will be answered. So don't be frustrated if it doesn't happen in the time frame that you arbitrarily put on it. Does that make sense to everybody? Just like right now, Louisa's going through a thing. She went to visit her mother for a week in Vancouver, and her whole life changed in a week. Where one chain reaction started, where her grandmother was sick, the mother had to leave. Louisa had to go take care of her sister because her mother can't do it, and she wants to have an apartment and a job. And it was just a chain reaction that changed her life. She wasn't planning on that. And so she, you know, things happen that we have to see, well, it'll take some time, but you ultimately realize there's something in. Because what is our philosophy? Not a blade of grass. Mm-hmm. And he was not the sanctioned Lord. So that was not her plan. But it happened, and she'll learn something from that. So many times in my life, there have been things that happened that, my goodness, I wasn't in my top, I sure hope that happens to me list. But it did. And I learned from it. It's usually in retrospect that you learn, right? Not when you're experiencing it. Mm-hmm. It's like kind of after it's over. Mm-hmm. When you're in the middle of a suffering or a big test condition, you kind of, you're not Draupadi yet. Don't throw your hands up and go, okay, Krishna, lay it on. You don't do that. You go, please lessen it a little bit. It's a little too much for me. I'd like to surrender, but. Hey, oh, all boys to this Sunday program. I hope you just get into it more and more. It's again your amazing teacher. So much to be learned by Sharon. And we are here for you all the time. Just remember that. All of you. Anyway. Just always remember that. Hare Krishna.
Krishna. So please
comfort Sanatana Goswami for Sharon. Sanatana Goswami. Jai. Sunday program at Govardhan Academy. Key.
Jai.
I am Radhiki Jaya.
Jaya.
Jaya. Jaya. Jaya.
No, for 20 years. She was 5 years old and she's 25. And I think she was like 8.
No, I think it's 6. Like, how many different years is she a new?
I'm not sure.
I think she was 84. Remember, Dina, we were 84?
Well, yes.
Wasn't she born?
84.
83 or 84?
She might be 24.
27?
I was 82, and I'll be 28.
Okay.
In September.
So, yeah, close to
26, 25.
Yeah.
Anyway, she's always been her mother says, a bit of a, you know, very dramatic.
She's a twin of her mother.
Yeah.
They're both the same.
Yeah.
They burn hot.
So she's done modeling and she's done all kinds of strange
she
things.
She was in the ashram with me.
Yeah.
I know.
She's got, she got her bachelor's degree. Now she's going to UCLA. This is the latest thing. It changes all the time. She's going to enter law school at UCLA, apparently. But I don't know how long she'll stay.
She doesn't seem to.
But for the last 2 years, she's been living with an Indian Babaji in
about
India.
90 years old.
A 90-year-old Babaji who sounds like a combination between a Sahajiya and some strange... I mean, not no Vaishnava, just a Babaji, you know. And then she broke off with him when we were in...
Oh, she directed cancer from her girl.
She was following
him. Oh, we'd love to. We'd love squash.
His, you know,
it's squash
very attached to keeping
don't
them here.
No.
And when she broke off with him, they
thank you, sweetest. Yeah, we're just
seeing
so many to eat.
When we were there, we never saw her. She didn't come out of it. Anyway, so she's coming, and she particularly expressed a desire to see you.
So next weekend.
Next, they're coming Monday.